some effort on behalf of organizations like Sabeel and others, Jews with Justice, and some other organizations to bring attention to these issues. And so I think there's been enough time now that more information has gotten out, and it takes time for people to be informed. And it just took this long because there's such a lack of readily available information in our mainstream media.
Now, Sabeel is an organization that represents Palestinian Christians. For people who aren't familiar, can you maybe talk about the fact that there are Palestinian Christians? I know when a lot of people think about Palestinians, they think of the Muslim Society.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true. There is a wonderful group that represents the Palestinian Christians that are a very small and but fairly vocal group, and they've been around for quite a long time. And they also work with the Muslim community there in Jerusalem. They're based in Jerusalem. We had a conference in April here in Portland, a Sabeel conference that was excellent. We had lots of speakers from both the Middle East and this country and Europe, and they represented both Palestinians, other Arabs, and I would say about half people from the Jewish community who are definitely in favor of justice, peace with justice, and also many of them were also in favor of BDS, the whole BDS movement.
And that BDS stands for a boycott, divestment,
and
sanctions.
Yes.
And so this resolution that was passed by the Presbyterians is part of the divestment part
well,
of that.
Well, it's just a small step, as I said. It's not divesting of everything that Israel sells or makes or all countries or companies that do business. Like I said before, it's very targeted, and it's a very good first step. And I think for the faith community, it's important not to go too far too fast, but to give signals and to make progress, and that's what has been done.
And for people who may have missed that April conference of the Friends of Sabeel North America, KABU recorded many of the talks, some of which are available on our website. And the panel on the peace talks that included both Phyllis Bennis and Zaha Hassan will air this Friday on June 27th at 9 a.m. So tune into KABU for that at 9 a.m. on June 27th to hear more about the status of the peace talks and the failures of the peace talks. And for people who are interested in finding out more about divestment, Roberta, is there a place that they can go to find more information?
I haven't really checked it out in the last few days, but except right when the decision came down. But the Presbyterian USA website is www.pcusa.org. So I would guess that there would be more information on that website.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Roberta Badger-Kane. She is with the First Presbyterian Church here in Portland and part of the Advocacy and Social Justice Group at that church. The Presbyterian Church passed on Friday at their general meeting a resolution calling for selective divestment from certain companies that do business with the Israeli military. More information can be found on their website, pcusa.org. That's for the Presbyterian Church, USA.org. Thank you so much for joining us today, Roberta.
You're welcome.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KABU News.
Jackson County, Oregon recently faced off with some of the most powerful corporations in the world when local farmers led an effort to ban the growth of GMO crops. But a recently passed state law, first written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, means that, for now, no other municipality in Oregon may do so. Where did the ALEC bill come from, and how was it passed? We take a closer look at ALEC in Oregon with a special report by KABU's investigative news team on Jackson and Josephine County's GMO bans on Tuesday, June 24th at 5:45, right after the evening news.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
The time is 6:05 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up. It's Labor Radio.
This is Jamie Partridge, Labor Radio. We're out here in front of the Oregon Zoo on a Saturday morning with a big line. People waiting for the zoo to open up at 9 a.m. And out here, walking along the line, are folks in blue t-shirts saying, "Fighting for Portland's future, laborers 483," which is the folks who represent the workers here at the zoo.
There you go. Feel free to say solidarity to all the little workers.
This is Jamie Partridge
with KBOO, hey. The radio. Can I get a few words for you, sure. From you for the radio?
Sure. Do you guys want some stickers?
Thank you.
There you go. Would you like one?
Ah, okay.
And what's your name?
My name is Dana Carstensen.
And you work here?
I do work at the Oregon Zoo.
And what kind of work do you do?
I work in admissions and guest services.
You're passing out stickers today. What do the stickers say?
Solidarity.
What's that about?
Solidarity is just a term the workers came up with to show some solidarity between the workforce, within the workforce, rather. So, you know, a way of showing support for each other.
And so why is solidarity important today?
Right now, we're trying to get a good contract and negotiations, a good fair contract, really. So solidarity, it's fun, it's positive, and that's what the Oregon Zoo is all about. It's having a positive experience. So, customers and patrons, they want to support the Oregon Zoo through, their patronage. And, employees, they want to support each other and a good quality experience with the patrons. So, a good fun term and solidarity and solidarity. It's, I think a good one and an important thing. So.
This is your first contract, right? Attempt to get a contract with management, and what are the issues that are important to you here?
Well, this will be the first contract for all the food workers. This will be just a continuing contract for, say, animal keepers and admissions. But what's important for us is, all the quote-unquote temp workers here, some who've been temp up to 20 years, some basic rights like sick days. We don't have sick days. All temp workers don't have sick days. When we're serving up to 200,000 customers every month, it's important to have sick days, for our teamwork and for public service, because, we don't want to get anybody sick, whether it be employee or customer. Another one is, a living wage, something we can actually survive on. We love working at this Oregon Zoo, but we have to have a wage where we can actually be able to live on it and continue working at the Oregon Zoo instead of looking for other jobs, because we want to work here.
I hear your folks are picking up the 15 now demand, the global $15 minimum wage demand. Is that right?
We are. We are asking for a minimum of $15 an hour at the Oregon Zoo for all employees. We decided that, if we're not getting any vacation days or sick days or grievance rights or, really any kind of or guaranteed hours even, the very least we could have is, $15 an hour, especially with, an entity that again, has well over a million customers every year. It's, the Oregon Zoo is the largest paid attraction of all of Oregon. So, you know, if we don't get anything when it comes to benefits, we don't even get, you know, healthcare, we don't think $15 an hour is asking for much. So,
thank you, Dana
Carsonson.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. So I'm talking with Ann McDonald, who last time I interviewed her, she was out with the United Campaign Workers, who were struggling for $15 an hour. And I understand that you folks in the food service here at the zoo are also asking, trying to get $15 an hour.
Yeah, that's right. Our bargaining team proposed that to Metro at a bargaining session a couple weeks ago. So we're going to see what happens with that.
Some kind of buzz out here about 15.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, it's growing too. It's really exciting.
So what are you going to be doing with the workers today at the zoo?
Mostly some public outreach, visibility. We just want to kind of talk to the public about what we're dealing with, what our struggles are. We want them to have a good, you know, good day at the zoo. We're handing out stickers for all the kids. So we're just trying to kind of, you know, make them more aware of when they're buying their tickets, you know, what that person is going through, when they're buying their burger, you know, kind of what that person is dealing with, try to reach out a little bit, public engagement.
Are you talking to folks about the temping of the workforce?
Yeah, that's one of the major issues, especially in the food and admissions. So, like, the entire guest services department is mostly operated by temporary staff. So we want people to be aware that even though they're coming to visit all year, we're only temporary.
So what message do you have for our listeners out in labor radio land about how they can be supportive of your struggle here?
If they want to contact Metro and let them know that they're aware of what's going on and that they care about it. Anytime they come in, if they just want to, you know, give a nod to the workers they see, we feel that and we definitely appreciate it.
So what is the salute?
Zoolidarity.
Thank you, Ann McDonald.
All right, thank you. Oh
my goodness. All right, all right. I was just talking with Dana, one of the zoo workers, about how people could get a hold of the zoo workers. They have a Facebook page now called Oregon Zoolidarity, just like it sounds. Facebook page. Check them out. You've been listening to Labor Radio, KBOO Portland. In our next segment, we're talking with Midge Purcell of the Portland Urban League. Good evening, this is Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio. My guest this evening is Midge Purcell of the Urban League, and we're talking about Ban the Box, which is a campaign that's being sponsored by the Urban League, the Oregon AFL-CIO, and Oregon Action. So, good evening, Midge.
Good evening.
What is Ban the Box?
Ban the Box is part of a national movement, and it is a movement to get the question off of application forms that ask whether a person has had previous convictions or even previous arrest records. We know that people who have had previous experience with the criminal justice system have incredible barriers in terms of finding employment and also finding housing. And the removal of that box at the application stage just gives people a level playing field. It, instead of having HR people kind of look at that application and deposit it in the round file, it gives people an opportunity to be chosen for interview, to make their case, to highlight their suitability for the job. And if there has to be a background check, we'll be able to talk about the context of that arrest record or previous conviction. and whether or not it's applicable to the job. But what it does, it allows people to get their foot in the door in order to make a case for why they should be employed. And it is a campaign that has developed around the country, and we currently have at least 50 municipalities or jurisdictions that have passed ordinances to compel employers to take that question off of application form.
So tell us about the problem. Why is this a problem? What kind of experiences are happening out there? What kind of barriers are people facing?
Right. Well, I think that we have to understand the scale of people's engagement with the criminal justice system in this country. Over 65 million Americans have criminal records. That's the size of the country of France. So it is a huge problem. It is a particularly huge problem for people of color who have disproportionate engagement with the criminal justice system just because of the discrimination within the criminal justice system, which has been well documented. So, we believe that this affects all workers. It affects some workers to greater degree than others, but it is a barrier. There are a lot of employers who do not consider employing people with a criminal background a liability, and part of that is just, I think, because of assumptions and not having experience with employing someone who can make a contribution to their business or contribution to their enterprise. So we feel that it's a barrier that can be removed, and it'll be beneficial not only to the person that has previous convictions who have had a hard time finding a job, but it will also be beneficial to business, because I think that a lot of businesses are just missing a huge pool of potential talent and people who can make a huge contribution to their enterprise.
So research shows that a criminal record reduces the likelihood of a job callback or offer by nearly 50%. Ooh, so there are thousands of people in Oregon that are facing this barrier, and where this barrier has been removed, things have changed considerably. Is that right?
Yes. As I said, at least 50 jurisdictions, both counties and cities, have passed this ordinance. One in particular, in Minnesota, before the Ban the Box ordinance was passed, only 6% of people who had applied for positions actually got callback for interview and achieved employment. And after the Ban the Box legislation or ordinance was passed, 66% achieved a callback, and it's made a significant impact in terms of reducing the barriers to employment. Now, I just want to say that this isn't a panacea. I think that it's one measure, one small measure that, as I said before, will help people get the foot in the door. But there are other measures that I think that we need to look at in terms of incentives to ensure that, you know, employers do not discriminate against people with previous convictions. There's the issue of expungements and closed records that often don't work as effectively as they can. I think that we need to revisit that. But I think what we're talking about is beginning to create an environment with people who have done their time. They have paid their debt to society, if indeed that debt was justified, because we also know that a lot of people find themselves in the criminal justice systems unjustly. But once they've come out, we feel that we need to ensure that they have a fair chance to succeed. It's just common sense that if a person cannot find a job, cannot find adequate housing, then the likelihood of recidivism has escalated exponentially. So we feel that it's just common sense that we need to ensure that people have the ability to contribute to our society, and we just need to make sure that we reduce those barriers to enable them to do so.
I'm looking at a fact sheet here that says that a recent study showed that 65% of women with felonies on their record rely on family members for support, and for men it's 83%. So employment is a huge problem for people with felony records. And it's a single, as you said, probably the single most important influence in recidivism or not, going back or not. And then, of course, there's this huge, huge problem that's been created by the drug war over the last 30 years that's impacted predominantly or disproportionately black men who are coming out of prison. How is that... A lot of why the Urban League is involved with this struggle?
Absolutely. That's actually why that the Urban League has prioritized this issue. We know that, number one, that African-American unemployment, black unemployment, has hovered around 18% for the last several years. Even when the economy improves for everyone, that black unemployment still remains high. One of the reasons, I mean, there are many reasons. I think there are structural reasons for that. But one of those structural reasons is the fact that African Americans have been disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system and our system of mass incarceration. The policies of that mass mass incarceration, as you alluded to, I think escalated during the 80s and the so-called war on drugs, which actually turned out to be a war on my community, and had a particular impact on African American men. And, you know, we're talking about, I mean, in the main, we're talking about minor, fairly minor drug offenses. I was in a meeting yesterday when someone mentioned the legalization of marijuana in the state of Washington. And that person said, had that been done, and I'm not advocating one way, this is not a plug around the legalization of marijuana, but I think that it really does make the case that if that law was in place 10 years ago, 10,000 black men would not have been incarcerated. So you know, we see that that these laws and these policies have had a disproportionate impact. And the consequences continue, you know, when we're talking about the ability for people to reintegrate into the economy and the ability to find stable housing.
So you're mentioning housing. This ordinance, which is being proposed, what, for the city of Portland and possibly for the state of Oregon, it's called A Fair Chance for All, Reduce Barriers, Ban the Box, would also apply as in addition to employment to housing and to licensing.
That's correct. We modeled this ordinance on similar ordinances that have been passed in Newark, New Jersey, and Philadelphia, and Seattle. And those ordinances are, I call it the Cadillac of ordinances. It addresses all of those things that are fundamental barriers for people to be successful when they try to reintegrate into society. So we know that housing is another issue that or another area that often discriminates against people who have previous convictions. Many housing applications ask whether you have had previous convictions. Now, I think that these blanket bans, again, act in a discriminatory way. By no way are we saying that landlords should not have the means to check or to screen who is applying for housing. We're not saying that landlords shouldn't have the means to ensure that a tenant is safe and, you know, have the mechanisms to protect other tenants. But it can be done without blanket bans.
I noticed that in this fact sheet that it talks both for employment and for housing about that an employer or a landlord must consider that any past conviction is directly related to, for example, in employment, the duties and responsibilities of the job, or whether the position offers the same opportunity for the offense, the particular offense, to occur, the length of time since the offense has occurred. Again, a landlord has to consider the nature of the crime. So the ordinance itself has written into it that it's on the burden of the employer or the landlord to show that a criminal history is particularly relates to a reason for excluding an applicant.
It puts into place kind of a fair process. You know, what we're talking about is getting rid of blanket bans. And what we're talking about is a fair employment process. We're asking employers to, if they must do a background check, do it at the end of the process, because people will have an opportunity, again, demonstrate what they can do. We're asking an employer to evaluate whether a background check is necessary in terms of the nature of the job. If someone is digging trenches, then it may not be necessary to ask for a background check. You know, if someone is working with cash all the time, it might be necessary. But to be able to make a good faith assessment as to whether background checks are necessary. And also to consider things like the length of time. You know, if someone has not reoffended in 20 years, there is a likelihood that that person will not reoffend. So taking all of these things into consideration, we think, is just fair employment practice.
So we're talking in here with this campaign of banning the box in all employment, private and public employment, and also with licensing.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Again, some licensing applications ask whether a person have had previous convictions. And again, sometimes they're absolutely unnecessary. You know, if If it's a professional license in an area where a previous conviction doesn't matter, then it should not be a barrier to getting a professional license. You know, a lot of the, we would hope that in addition to kind of the cities, you know, kind of granting of licensing, that a lot of the licensing bodies also kind of look at this. And if we, you know, kind of take this to the state level, this is certainly a conversation that we would like to have with a lot of licensing bodies, that that there should not be blanket bans on people who are trying to get into a profession, need a professional license, and have their past criminal history count against them. It kind of goes against kind of the whole issue of kind of redemption.
So Midge Purcell of the Urban League, we're talking about the Ban the Box, Fair Chance for All campaign. We're running out of time here, but can you tell us a little bit about what your next steps are, what you hope to, how you hope to roll this campaign out and how people can get involved?
Right. We are moving forward in the city of Portland. We are having conversations with city commissioners who we hope will support the ordinance. We are also having this conversation in the community. We are really delighted that we have strong labor partners who understand that this issue affects their members and their potential members. Community-based organizations, the labor movement, are having this conversation. We have a petition campaign. We hope to collect thousands of signatures to show the strength of feeling in the community on this issue. We're asking for organizational endorsements. So if you're part of an organization who feels that they would like to endorse the campaign, we hope that you'll get in touch with